Hi, I'm Vince Mickens. Welcome to All Things Aviation and Aerospace. As all of you know who watch this show, I pretty much get excited about anything that has to do with flying. Well, today's no exception, and as much as I love being behind the controls of anything that flies, I think it would almost equally be exciting being tethered in the doorway of an aircraft, taking photos and things like that. What is really masterful, though, is being in an airplane or a blimp operating the controls of a gyro stabilized camera with such precision that it can follow a golf ball close up from being hit off the tee and dropping to the green. I call it a miracle shot to see something like that and know somebody's able to capture that. And we have the person that is actually has that kind of expertise on the show today and kind of pioneered that. So we're going to talk about that and much more after I introduce three very talented, what I call image makers, joining me today. So that master manipulator of the gyro stabilized camera, he's none other than Bob Michelson, a sports broadcasting Hall of Famer who has an incredible story to tell. And then just when I thought that was the ultimate and cool, in my search for a female aerial photographer, I came across an aeronautical photographer, Diane Bond. Diane gets a kick out of getting incredible shots while being strapped in a helicopter. And she's also this year's grand prize winner of the Helicopter Association International's Rotor Magazine photo contest. Then to round everything out with this incredible group, I dropped a line to a former colleague at AOPA, the Aircraft Owner and Pilots Association, who, like Diane, gets a kick out of being tethered in at altitude in airplanes, taking impressive air-to-air photos of, you guessed it, other airplanes. Chris Rose. Chris Rose, Diane Bond, Bob Michelson, welcome to All Things Aviation and Aerospace.
Thanks for having us.
It's really great to have you guys, and I'm really looking forward to our conversation about this. This is, you know, another area in aviation that you don't hear people talking about every day, but we witness it one way or another, whether it's in a photograph or in Bob's case, if you're watching one of the football games or golf matches, or Bob will have to tell the story about the Kentucky Derby last year. Catching shots like that from the air and just making the broadcast all that much better. Bob, you have an interesting start to this. And one of the great things with actually all three of you is your interesting starts. You didn't start out doing what you're doing now. So you had different influences that kind of took you in that direction. So Bob, starting with you, tell us a little bit about how you stumbled into.
To be upfront, I'm in my early 70s. And so I grew up at the age where you'd sit on the floor in grade school and watch the first Mercury flights go off. So like any kid that age, you wanted to be in aviation. But as you can see, I wear glasses. And back in those days, that killed any chance of being an astronaut.
Yeah, wearing oxygen masks.
That wasn't going to happen. But always was fascinated by it. My dad was very active in politics in Minnesota. So when I got out of a 2-year stint in the Army over in Germany in public affairs, so I was doing photography and had a dark room to play around with. I ended up out in Washington interning with Hubert Humphrey and did the Carter campaign thing and ended up as a political appointee at the FAA as an AD administrator and Langer and Bond. And so I got my pilot's license under his direction. I have a great letter that I framed where he told me he wanted me to get a pilot's license. And I started a career in aviation. I had my media background. I was a communications major. And I had gone out to Oshkosh that year and saw a Helio Courier, a short takeoff and landing aircraft, and thought, hey, this would be great. You know, so I hit the road and started making phone calls. And realized I got a NBC said, we really need something stabilized, with big lenses. We don't know how to do that. And the FAA library was across the hallway from my old office. And so I went there and did research and saw pictures of things that would work. And went to the government printing office bookstore, which is next to Union Station, and got a copy. I don't know if you can still do it, but a copy of the Pentagon phone directory. And in there, I found that there was a guy at the Air Force who handled radio TV liaison and told him what I was looking for. And I go, yeah, no problem. We'll get you one. And so it was a stabilized camera mount that was in the Spectre gunship. It was a big rectangular frame and I could bolt anything into it. Went to the different networks and NBC said, sure, we'll give you a shot. And basically I went to manufacturers Canon for optics, Ikigami, which was a camera maker like Sony, and put together a system, a 40-to-1 lens. So for you still people, that's, 50 to 2000 millimeter zoom lens, and put that together. And we put it in the Goodyear blimp in 1984 and started shooting. I didn't realize at the time that I had put together the most capable video system from the air on the planet.
What was the spark for that? What made you say, let me do this?
Well, I was unemployed for one, so you're very motivated.
That's always a good spark, yeah.
I had to find things. I had a pilot's license, a private pilot license, and like any kid that gets a pilot, I was 30 years old, that you feel the world owes you a career in aviation, which they don't. And so that was what got started, and they weren't interested in an airplane. They got the blimp for free. It was a commercial trade-off, aerials provided by. That's what pays for the whole thing. But they needed and were looking for aerials for golf because there was no high point like in a stadium to do overhead shots. And then we did that and then did that in 85. Then 86, they wanted me to operate the equipment. They didn't want to send their own people out. And they were getting changes in union contract at the network so vendors could operate their own equipment.
Hmm.
So a lot of changes were going on in the industry where the original families were getting out of the business and selling the corporations. It was all about money. And as an example, the networks no longer had 20 foreign correspondents in every capital of the world. There'd be one person in London handling Europe. One in Tokyo handled the Far East, that kind of stuff. So there's right. a lot of... And so the networks got out of owning stuff. And so vendors like myself not only provided a hardware, but we also became the operators of it. And we also, in effect, became the R&D shop for that. So you get specifications that say, hey, can you do something like this and all that? And so
you kind of became the research and development.
Yeah, focus. Exactly. And that happened in a lot of places. Guys who did the in-car cameras for auto racing took that on instead of the networks trying to develop that. That's an example. The production trucks are no longer owned by the networks. They're rented out. The networks may specify what they want, say, we want a truck like this, and then it's built and by someone else.
What was it like your first time going up in a blimp to do this?
It was in the Goodyear blimp down in Pompano Beach. Because I had a pilot's license, less than 100 hours, so I was used to that. But in college, I jumped out of airplanes for fun. And so all of those things, it didn't bother me being on the air, 1,000, 2,000 feet in the air. And so, there weren't any new sensations that I hadn't experienced.
Okay.
I was very comfortable doing that. And as a kid, I was into music, playing clarinet and saxophone through college. So I had, eye, hand.
Oh, my two instruments.
Yeah. So so those kinds of things, muscle reflexes and, hardwired to do things with your fingertips and stuff. I didn't have to learn a lot. There was obviously new things to look at, but some basic stuff that I see new guys having to play with weren't an issue with me.
So you're flying in a blimp, you're doing video from the blimp, and at some point with the programs changing in terms of using a blimp or the company, you tell us about you transitioning to an aircraft and making that move.
Well, I did that because frankly the Goodyear operates a first class operation, but they try to do everything in house. And but a large corporation, you know, they're not as agile on buying new equipment, and they were using technicians who didn't have necessarily an artistic background or communications background to do camera. And so they were waiting to be directed, and it's too late then.
You froze on us there. Let me go to you, Diane. You are you're from a small town in Mississippi where it happens to have been a helicopter factory, a Eurocopter that eventually became Airbus Helicopters. And tell us how you got drawn into that and got started with it.
So I majored in communications in college, and so I had an interest in business and commercial and marketing. And when I became a photographer, it made sense to become a commercial photographer. So that's kind of where a lot of my interests were. And I had done some work with a marketing firm that was hired to put on basically a party, a ceremony when American Eurocopter got their production certificate. And so I went, was hired and photographed the party. And, you know, it's kind of just a basic people meet and greet. And from there, they hired me again to photograph more of buildings being built and people and parties and events. And
so aviation, as in you flying in a helicopter and taking shots, hadn't happened yet.
Not even on the radar. I had never even been up close to a helicopter. At some point, they started producing the helicopters and they started coming off the final assembly line. And I was hired to photograph the first Lakota, and that was produced. And at some point, the helicopter started flying. And I don't think I was ever asked, can you photograph in the air? But I was told, we're going to go photograph the helicopter in the air. And so they didn't say I couldn't. I didn't say I couldn't. And I ended up in the air. And my first air to air actually was for a magazine cover. And the deadline was the next day. And wow. I had no experience. And I had flown in a helicopter one time before to photograph aerials of the plant being built, but never done an air-to-air shoot. And so the deadline is the next day, and I've got to make it happen. And I just probably prayed a lot and I pointed my camera and I shot, and they were happy. It made the cover and they had me back. And so that just kind of grew to more and more photo shoots and more experience. And every time I get in a helicopter, I still learn more. And
you discovered you actually liked it.
I did. I think I was too nervous the first time, too nervous about getting the shot, that I didn't have time to be nervous about flying in a helicopter with the doors off. And,
you were more worried about the final product.
Absolutely. Still to this day, all I want to do is get the shot and make whoever I'm working for happy and tell the story in the right way. So now, you know, I get to go all over the country and do customer profiles on the people that fly the helicopters and the missions they serve. And that's where I am today.
So you've also done photography out of a lot of different types of helicopters that have a lot of different usage. Does that include military helicopters as well, built by Airbus?
Yes. So my primary focus for about the first 12 years was on the Lakota, and then kind of moved into different aspects. Do a lot of the H-135, H-145. I'm usually flying in an H-125 to get the shots, but sometimes I get to fly in the 145s. Or
nice.
The
225s. Nice. Chris, you grew up with your parents being into photography, I think as a hobby, if I read correctly.
Yeah.
So cameras were around the house all the time. And also you had an affinity for graphics, which you studied in school.
Correct.
And all of that has brought you to where you are. So take us back. Tell us about your roots of photography.
Yeah. So, well, my mom was a very avid amateur photographer. My grandfather was had worked as both a professional and later an amateur photographer. But we always had cameras around the house, and my mom was always very good about no matter what I was taking pictures of, she would send it off to the York Photo Labs. I remember that was that's where you sent all your film off to. And so she always encouraged photography around the house, and that just sort of stuck with me. And my grandfather handed down some old 35 millimeter cameras that I would play around with. But which is one of the reasons why when I went into college, I went to Shepherd College, which now Shepherd University near Harper's Ferry, West Virginia, and decided that, I enjoyed photography. It was my minor in college, but for some reason, I just wasn't quite sure I was going to be able to make a living doing it. And I certainly didn't want to do portraits of, babies and puppies. So decided that I would go the graphics route. And that was my major in college. And then it's actually my senior year in college that my girlfriend's roommate, believe it or not, who was a year ahead of us, got a job at sort of as a marketing assistant at AOPA. And my senior year, she called me and said, hey, there's a position that's opening up at AOPA. If you'd be interested, I think I could get you an interview. I was sort of seeing it as a part-time position because obviously I was still finishing out my senior year, but I went down and interviewed, had my big portfolio case and was wearing the probably my first suit that I had ever bought as an adult. and I went down there and I met with a handful of people from their marketing department. They looked at my portfolio and, I explained what my position was in college currently. And they said, we like your stuff and we'd like to offer you the position. And for some reason, my mind sort of said to myself, okay, well, they're offering me this position after I graduate, in a few months. Well, they were wanting me to start like on Monday, and this was Friday. So
were you a pilot at the time? Had you?
I wasn't. I really the only person in my family that was a pilot was my uncle, who was a very experienced pilot, used his Bonanza to travel all over North America. He was in the mining business, but no real direct connection. My dad sort of dabbled in the ultralight craze back in the early 80s a little bit, but that was
more
that
power to him.
Exactly. So I interviewed. They hired me that day, and I remember heading back to college. I was still in the dorms, and stopping off halfway at a payphone, calling my professor and saying that I just had this job offer. And he's like, well, I hope you took it. And I said, I did.
But you're like, yeah, I have to figure out how to
finish my classes, because I start on Monday. He's like, we'll work that out. So
tell us about the transition from graphics and photography on the weekends to doing what you do now. And now you're a senior photographer doing a lot of air to air.
Right. So, so for the first decade that I was at AOPA, I started in 1993 and again, commuted my first day at work. I commuted from my dorm room, which was slightly embarrassing because at that time AOPA was, sort of formal dress. So, when everybody else was stumbling back doing their walk of shame back to the dorms in the morning, I was leaving with a briefcase, in a suit. but I started as a graphic designer for AOPA. And then about a decade later, I was the art director for AOPA. And I was doing some photography on the side. I was doing photography, on sort of as a freelance gig on the side to make a few extra bucks on the weekends.
Was that air to air or just other kinds?
No. This was just like standard commercial photography, restaurants and, hotels and stuff like that in the local area.
Gotcha.
But I started doing a little bit of it for AOPA, and then that just sort of grew. And then eventually AOPA purchased a second monthly magazine, AOPA Flight Training. And of course, our website was developing at the time. So, AOPA's appetite for photography just continued to grow and grow and grow. And it still is.
And your opportunity started to grow.
And my opportunity continued to grow. And I just developed a passion for aviation photography. I would go along with the other photographers on air-to-air shoots. And I just really, really enjoyed it. So I guess it was probably 15 years ago. I started doing it more on a full-time basis, and then it just developed from there.
So I'm going to bring all of you on now. Bob, are you back with us?
Well, I'm, how about audio? Do you hear me?
Yes, we sure do. And it looks like you had to go to your cell phone.
I mean, the internet in my hotel room just died.
I was going to say, full disclosure, you're in a hotel room on the West Coast, if I'm not mistaken.
I am.
So we totally understand.
Sorry about that.
So while you were doing that, we had a chance, I had a chance to talk with both Diane and Chris about their backgrounds and everything. And let's get into a little bit of the nitty gritty of this for our viewers. And that is about you guys and the specifics of what you do. And I'll do it in a few different fashions. But one thing I wanted to ask, and I think I'll start with you, Chris, and that is, so tell us about one of your experiences or maybe even your first experience of doing an air to air, being strapped in or tethered into an aircraft that's got the door off, et cetera,
right,
and shooting your air to air photographs.
You know, one of the first air to air missions that I really remember was Cirrus Aircraft had just been really kind of making the SR-22 for a handful of years. This was probably back in the, you know, mid, maybe the early 2000s I remember going on a photo shoot. I think it was like in March or something like that. And it was just one of these really, really nice March days in Frederick. It was like 65 degrees on the ground. It was just really nice. And I had not really calculated the fact that it was going to be a lot colder at altitude. So we took off. I was strapped in. You know, I had a fairly good sense of what I needed to do, but we got up there and I got really cold, but I didn't want to seem like an amateur and, you know, complain because we, you know, we were trying to shoot this cover and
fingers turning purple, lips turning blue. I'm okay.
And I never, knock on wood, I've not made that mistake again, but that was a very memorable first shoot for me because when I landed, I was chilled to the bone. So from then on out, I always made sure that I was overdressed because you can always take a jacket off up there, but you can't put much on when you don't have it with you. So that was definitely one that I remember.
Diane, you've done a lot of different types of shoots in the helicopters. Is there one that stands out to you that was just extra exciting, maybe the size of the helicopter or the type of shoot you had to do for an air to air, et cetera?
So probably two that stand out. One was shooting in downtown LA and just flying around the skyscrapers. And, you know, I'm from a small town in Mississippi, so not that I haven't traveled, but to be in a big town and get to see it from a different angle and photograph, you know, different backgrounds than just a river or some farmland. So one, I think the helicopters that I get to photograph are beautiful and works of art themselves. So when I get to combine the beauty of the helicopter with just an incredible background and work to make it a piece of art, that's what I think is exciting and thrilling. And so, you know, the actual flying is incredible. And then also the making the art is incredible. Another one actually is the shoot where I photographed the 225 doing some training for military parajumpers, and to photograph a mission, a real mission. It was a training mission, but a real mission versus a setup for a photo shoot. You know, when you're photographing people who are really doing their job, and you get to be in the middle of that and capture all the emotion, you know, the high activity and the stress, and see people doing their job well. And I think that's something that I love telling people's stories. I love learning people's stories. And then when I get to tell the stories through the photography, is something that I just love to do.
Yeah. Bob, so it sounds like all of you look at it from a creative perspective in terms of what you're able to compose with your photography. Bob, would that also apply to you with what you, I mean, some of the shots that you guys have done, that Wing Vision has done and you have done, are incredible looking from both the blimp and from the aircraft, which is pretty amazing to see it from both perspectives. Share with us your thoughts about that.
Well, I, you know, being on on this with two photographers. I view what I do from an artistic standpoint, much like the photographers do, except I'm doing 30 photographs a second. And so I like to think that any one frame of video would stand alone artistically. And it's difficult to do that when you're shooting live. We do some pre-tape for some shows, but basically everything we do is live. It's microwave
on the fly, so to speak.
Yeah, so to speak. And so you framing and composition is still very, very important. And, just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Pebble Beach, Monterey Peninsula, the California
absolutely
coast.
Absolutely beautiful there.
Absolutely gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. This past weekend, I was in Phoenix in the Goodyear blimp. CBS brings me in to shoot golf out of the Goodyear blimp. And then I also had an airplane there for Fox for Saturday and for pregame. And so we're doing that this weekend. I'm here in L.A. for golf, and I have an airplane out in Salt Lake for NBA All-Star game. Flying around in circles, just doing beauty shots.
Is that the Genesis Invitational?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Tiger's playing that. Yeah.
Yeah. I just saw that. That's why I knew about it. You see a picture of Tiger with a golf club in his hand, you're like, oh, he's back.
Yeah, well, it's absolutely incredible. What he's done for a game. We did all the MetLife blimp stuff, and the demographics in MetLife for golf are perfect. And they got their two blimps in the late 80s. And then in 97, 98, Tiger came along. And it just changed the whole vibe about golf. They're getting big numbers, advertising, the whole deal.
Yeah.
So it really changed things.
Yeah. So one of the things that Diane brought up, and I think this applies to all of you, is the amount of teamwork and coordination that it takes. Bob, I know particularly in broadcasting, live broadcasting, there's a large team of people that are, there's people in the booth and there's, people with other responsibilities, and you're a part of that and you're coordinated within that. Can you share a little bit your thoughts about that?
Yeah, well, absolutely. For even a golf, which is, I don't want to say it's a minor sport, but it's not the size of football or some of those. CBS, NBC, those, they'll have over 100 people, 100 to 120 that they travel for every event. So it's a huge amount of personnel that required. I don't know what Fox had for Super Bowl, but it would be a few hundred that right. go out there for the weekend. For me, the most important aspect for doing any air-to-air work is the pilot. The pilot really has, I get some young kids who just fly around in circles, and I get others who really get into it and understand it. Blimp pilots over time really become an extension of what you're looking at. They get it. They understand the lighting and anticipate where you need to go. So pilots are a huge part when you're doing air-to-air.
Yeah. Chris, I would imagine you have a lot to say about that with a lot of the different types of air-to-air that you've done.
Sure.
And looking back on your career, I mean, I've seen you shoot just about every kind of aircraft that's up there. But in terms of the pilot, teamwork, getting the right shot, the coordination that's really important when you have a couple of pilots flying the plane that you're in, that you're shooting from, and then the plane or planes that you're shooting.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. We obviously don't have quite as many people together on the team as Bob does, but it's typical for us to have, 4 to 5 individuals that are working on a specific photo shoot. Obviously, we have the photographer, we have the pilot of the platform, which that I'm in the photo ship, and then usually a safety pilot in that photo ship, and then 1 to 2 pilots in the subject aircraft. And, every photo mission starts with, a safety brief and a plan and then sort of a plan B and a plan C, because we're operating in very close tolerances, when we're actually in the photo, over the background that we're looking for. It's not unusual for us to be, 15 to 20 feet away from each other, wing to wing. So it's sort of this like welded wing and, in a tight turn. 150 knots, And there's really not a lot of room for error. So safety is absolutely super important for us. And and we always pay a lot of attention to that. And that's why we have a group of trained formation pilots that AOPA uses. And we travel together, you know, as a team around the country to wherever the aircraft that we're shooting is.
Asking about the equipment that you guys use. I'll start with you, Diane. What do you typically take up with you to do your air-to-air in the helicopters? And does it vary, or do you always take the same thing and then adjust accordingly?
I pretty much always take the same thing, and I have two cameras on me. And one is, I shoot with a Nikon, and I have a 70 to 200 lens. You have to have at least a 200 in case the subject ship is too far away. You have to be prepared for that. And then on my second camera, I have, I like to photograph with my 85, and sometimes I will, to get different backgrounds, I'll need a 50 or a 35. If for some reason we end up flying really close together, I have to use my 20, but that doesn't happen too often. So pretty much my 85 is my favorite, but sometimes it's not, just the conditions don't allow for it. So I use a 50, 35, and then my 70 to 200. Probably 70 to 200 is what most of my shots are on.
Chris, how about you?
Yeah, actually, 70 to 200 is one of my go-to lenses. I think it is for a lot of aviation photographers. I also use the 24 to 105. I'm on the Canon platform. Both L-series lenses, both image-stabilized lenses. I moved over to the mirrorless platform about a year and a half ago. How do you like that? You know, I do like it. I shoot some video along with the stills. And one of the nice things about the mirrorless cameras is that you can shoot video while looking through the eyepiece, which is important for me because, you know, oftentimes it's, you know, obviously really windy in the back of the aircraft. You've got a lot of, you know, you got light coming in through all the windows. So sometimes it's hard to see that, you know, the monitor on the back of the camera. So being able to look through the eyepiece is a real nice way to see that video as it's being shot.
You touched on it earlier, but tell us a little bit more about your setup with the gyro stabilized camera, and you were mentioning the lens size that you use now. So the setup you have for your aircraft that shoot all of these different things.
Yeah, we now have five airplanes that we have the two Helio Courier Tri-Gears, and we have three 206s. And each one has the gyro-stabilized system. Those are $420,000 camera systems. And they're equipped with a Sony camera that's now capable of 4K, although we're shooting in 1080p, high dynamic range mostly. The lenses are made by Canon. They have 4K glass, and those are 45-1. So to bring it into a still camera, that's the equivalent of 50-2250 lens that gets you down to about 1 degree. That's 2250 millimeter lens. That's the equivalent.
That's why you can follow a golf ball.
But I also have a 2x optical extender, which makes it a 100-4500 lens. And I use that a lot. There's also a digital zoom that takes it from, it's just a 2x extender, but it does it digitally. It changes how it scans the CMOS sensor. And that makes it 9,000 millimeters. But when it does that, it cuts it from high definition resolution down to standard definition. So that's rarely used.
What altitude are you typically flying at?
We're usually at about 1,500 in the blimp, and in the airplane, we're 2,000 to 2,500.
That's a great question. Diane, how about you? What altitude for the helicopters?
We're not usually very high. We're just above the treetops usually.
Oh, wow. Chris?
Yeah, usually around 2,500, anywhere 2,500 and below. We've done shoots as low as, you know, a couple hundred feet, if it's not over, you know, people, obviously. But usually, you know, if we're operating over populated areas, we're just a hair above 1,000 feet.
Yeah. So this brings me to another area that is one of the most important ones I like to talk about on this show, and that is giving advice and to our young viewers and to their parents and teachers and counselors and that type of thing in terms of pursuing a career like this. All of you have been doing it for a couple of decades or more. Bob, almost four, I guess.
Yeah.
Thereabouts.
About 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. So just like you to share your thoughts for young people that say they're kind of a avid photographer or hobbyist or whatever, and they never really thought about it. They love aviation, and now they're thinking, oh, I might want to do something like that. And I'll start with you, Diane.
So I did put in a little thought to this, and kind of have 4 points. And I think for any person, any young person going into any field, I would suggest taking some business classes. They're just going to do you right. You need to know business to go forward, I think. The second thing I would do is join your local flying organizations, EAA, Experimental Aircraft Association, AOPA, Women Aircraft Association, or WAI, whatever associations there are, join and be an active member. The connections you make in any field, but the connections you make are going to lead you to a career, or can lead you to a career. So I think joining those organizations are really good. Now, to go a step further, join the organizations, take your camera. When they put on events that are, you know, nonprofit for your organization, photograph. When you start photographing the nonprofit events, then at some point somebody's going to ask you, hey, can you photograph this for me? Your answer is yes, and you charge for it. And that will help you go from there. And my next thing is, don't overspend on equipment.
No, those are great tips. On the last one, you kept it short, but why not overspend on equipment?
Because you
need. What do you mean by that, actually?
In my field, I don't have to have a $400,000 camera. I can have a $2,000 camera and a $2,000 lens, but that's not what I started with. I started with much less than that. And I'm just a person who doesn't believe in going into debt. So if you spend more money on your camera than you're making, then you may not make it very far. So,
yeah.
Bob, I hear you chiming in on that.
Well, in my case, I get camera operators over the years. I've been lucky to have the same guys for 10, 15, even 20 years. But the ones that I get have had a background shooting news out of helicopters. And my view is, in any of these fields, that you don't want the hardware to get in the way of being creative. You need to know it. And so that I get guys who have hundreds, if not a few thousand hours of already flying every morning for nudes. So they understand the hardware, and we don't have to teach that. But shooting live sports is a lot different than shooting news. We'll go up and we're flying around in circles for 5 hours, and you really have to concentrate. And you start doing a Sunday night NFL game, and it gets to be close to midnight. It's hard to keep awake sometimes.
Yeah.
But
Let's hope the pilot does.
Well, you know, but the biggest issue for, you know, knowing what you're trying to speak to here is, I do hire pilots almost every year. I'm hiring a pilot or two. And one of the big issues that I have is getting guys, insurance kind of tells me that I need a pilot that has at least 500 hours. They're not going to let me have a 200-hour pilot. And this past year, I got two pilots out of Embry-Riddle in Prescott, and they've been marvelous. And I really like pilots who have flown in weather. I don't know how to say this and be nice about it, but my experience with pilots who have come out of Florida or southern states, they don't have the same level of experience as the guys who learned to fly up in North Dakota or Embry-Riddle. They haven't flown the mounds. They don't know what ice is. You know, they don't have
that's
that
a significant
kind of,
point.
And yeah, and I need that. And I really, because right away I have guys who need to fly IFR single pilot at night. I need guys who understand that every show we do in the fall with football, we're going to have a waiver from the FAA. You're going to have to coordinate with a phone call to the local TRACON or the local tower saying, hey, did you get the copy of the waiver? This is what we're going to do. This past weekend out in Phoenix for Super Bowl, one of our jobs was to follow the team buses in. Well, my pilot had to call, I think, three or four different towers and TRACON saying, this is what we need to do at these kinds of times. And one of the little sayings I have with my guys is, I can deal with problems, I can't deal with surprises. And the FAA is the same way. If you go ahead and talk to them ahead of time, it's amazing what they'll let you do. Absolutely amazing. But if you come in and just say, hey, I'm going to do this, they, you know, basically is, who the hell are you guys? You know, it's that kind of a deal.
No, that's really, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. You know, and the best example I have of that is many, many years ago, I think it's even on YouTube. I think it was in 05 or whatever. We did a pre-tape for Monday Night Football with the Navy and the Marine Corps. And it ended with a drill sergeant going in the middle of the field in San Diego, are you ready for some football? Well, we flew around the island around San Diego where the Navy has a base in formation with four Navy helicopters. And we spent, I don't know, 90 minutes doing that. And my pilot says, I can't believe we're doing this. right next to Lindbergh Field. And the helicopters are 1,000 feet, we're 500 feet above them. And, you know, it's those kinds of things. Or I get a call from Boeing, test pilots, and we're doing air-to-airs with a 787 down in South Carolina for the Hilton Head Golf. Or I get a call from the pilots of a B-2 that's flying a flyover at a football game. They want to make sure we're in the same vicinity, you know, what are you going to be at? So we're doing those kinds of things. And for these young pilots, I mean, they're just blown away.
Great experiences. Absolutely great.
Absolutely.
And a variety of them at that.
Every pilot that I've had when they interview for their next job says they walk in there, they look at the logbook, and the people cannot believe the experience they've had. My guys from Labor Day until now will have flown 400 hours.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Yeah. It's fabulous. Absolutely.
Yeah, I'm gonna let Chris, being with the Aircraft Owner and Pilots Association, being a pilot, kind of piggyback off of what you're talking about.
Sure, absolutely.
No, I get people that ask me from time to time, you know, how did you get your start? How can I get a start into it? You know, what I tell people is, you know, air shows are a great place to get a start in aviation photography. It's a safe, controlled environment. I certainly don't recommend anybody going out and doing air-to-air photography if they're not experienced in it. But there are people out there that do it. And, you know, most of the time, those people are willing to share that information and that knowledge. There's also some professional organizations that people can join, like ISAP, which is the International Society for Aviation Photography. And they've got a lot of great resources. You know, just hanging out at your local airport, making connections through people that spend a lot of time at airports. And you know, if you're really looking to go into it as a career, you know, there's always a military track too. A lot of aviation photographers I know got started in the military shooting for the military. So those are all great ways to get your feet wet in the in the industry. But, anytime anybody comes up to me, I'm always willing to share any information I have because, it's not proprietary. There's a formula to it, but sure. Safety is obviously paramount. So.
Yeah. You've talked about that in terms of safety before and all of you express that emphasis on safety, which for all of us in the industry is paramount. But Chris, you know, as a pilot, is there anything in particular that gives you a comfort level when you're going up in terms of the pilots that you're flying with?
Well, you know, I try to work with people that I know and that I've worked with before. I don't always have that luxury. Sometimes I'm working with new people, you know, and I, I sort of conduct an informal interview if typically there's some red flags that always pop up. You know, if somebody's doing a lot of bragging about, you know, oh, I used to fly, you know, in the military and I've got a ton of formation experience, that doesn't necessarily mean that they don't, but it causes me a little bit of concern because I've had people that say that they're very experienced and they weren't. So, you know, trying to find people that have practical experiences, there's also, you know, a fairly close network of aviation photographers and, you know, we chat between each other from time to time, as well as other platform pilots. So we know sort of some of the landmines to stay away from, but, usually a good safety briefing and making sure that everybody is fully aware of what their job and their role is in the photo shoot is a good place to start. And frankly, if there's ever a safety concern midway through a shoot, we simply stop the photo shoot and reevaluate on the ground.
Yeah. Diane, you've gotten to know a lot of helicopter pilots with all of the flying that you've done. Is there anything in particular that, you know, you kind of look for, or do you generally, because a lot of them are test pilots, et cetera, just trust what you're going with?
I don't think you necessarily just trust. You don't just trust. Just lots of safety briefings, lots of communication. You know, probably on every shoot, you know, you learn what you can do better and how I can communicate better. But we do it as safely as possible and really just talk about the mission, what we want to photograph, how we want to photograph. If something, you know, we talk about, you know, if something goes wrong, you know, what to do. And again, like you said, if there's a red flag or something doesn't go right, you stop and reevaluate. But yeah, lots of different pilots. I agree with you. A lot of people say they understand exactly what you want and have a lot of experience, and then you get in the air and they don't. So you try to address that before you get in the air.
Sure. I was going to also, Diane, ask you about this. So, you know, one of the areas that aviation in general is trying to do is diversify in terms of getting more women, as an example, into the industry. And as a matter of fact, the Women in Aviation International Conference is coming up in a week or two out in California. But as a female aerial photographer, do you have any specific thoughts about that or recommendations in terms of, have you had, you know, any challenges with that, or has it been, you know, pretty much just about your ability to do the photographs?
So being a woman in a male dominated industry, I will say I was never told that I couldn't. I was never told you can do anything you want. I just did and was welcomed. I would say 98% of the men I worked with support me and never look down on me. So I think I'm blessed in that. You know, sometimes I have to prove myself, but I think probably anyone does. So I think I've been really blessed to be supported as a female in this industry, and most of the guys out there want to help.
Yeah. So if you were at the Women in Aviation International Conference coming up and you ran into some young ladies that are interested in aviation, happen to be interested in photography, what type of advice would you share with them?
I just wouldn't say that you can't.
That's it, huh?
Yeah, I've had a lot of positive experiences, and I would just encourage them. And if, you know, there aren't a lot of females for me to talk with that do the same thing. So, but nobody's been negative towards me. So,
yeah.
So I would tell them that, like, just because you're a female doesn't mean it's going to be hard.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I agree.
Bob, not to put you on the spot, but what about in the broadcasting world? Are there any women videographer, photographers, or pilots that you've come across?
I haven't. There are in the news side of things. I haven't had women as photographers or videographers, but I have had a couple of young women as pilots.
Awesome.
And great. Which brings me to another point. You know, we're talking about young pilots. one of the biggest problems I have these days are guys weigh too much. I mean, I'm getting guys that are, you know, 240 pounds and you're in a small airplane. It's a big deal.
Yeah, it is.
You know, because we're flying around at, you know, basically gross weight. We have tip tanks on the 206s, which increases 200 pounds. But, you know, it's a problem. And I'll tell you a funny one, because you'd love this. On a 206, if there's no pressure on the nose gear, it locks mechanically forward. Well, all of a sudden I get a phone call, you know, from one of my pilots. They're taxiing out to do a show and he can't steer the airplane. And he's absolutely in a panic. They get it back to the ramp and he goes, "Oh my God." I said, "Well, who's your cameraman?" He goes, "Well, it's Jeff." Well, Jeff is a big guy. He's about 240 pounds. He's sitting in the back seat. And I said, "Take him out, see how it works." He goes, "Yeah, it works fine." I said, "Guess what?" Well, that was the plane, our turbo 206, that has air conditioning and the oxygen tank in the tail. And so when he's in the back there was no pressure on the nose gear, and so it locked forward.
Yeah.
But wow. those are common. I mean, that's an example.
Yeah. What an interesting story. I guess you could call it an incentive for a big guy like me to say,
you try to have a little come to Jesus with these kids and, you know, they're just like, "Hey, what are you talking about? Everybody I know weighs, you know, 220, 240.
Yeah.
For a long time I did on Find a Pilot, which I don't use anymore. I put FAA standard weight pilots. I used to put that on there. Yeah, well, I did, because it matters.
Yeah.
And I got two guys that wanted to file lawsuits against me for doing that. So it was discrimination. And I said, "It affects the performance of your job."
Right. And of the aircraft.
Absolutely. Yeah. I said, that's not discrimination. That's a real issue.
Yeah. So how much does the equipment weigh? The camera, the lens, the controls?
Yeah. Basically the stabilized camera out on the wing is about 65, 70 pounds.
Okay.
And then we have about, another 30 pounds of stuff, microwave equipment and power supplies and stuff in the baggage compartment.
Yeah. And you were mentioning earlier the cost of the gyro stabilizer. Does that include the lens?
Yeah. That's the whole pack. Well, the answer is yes. But, you know, the lens is what we have. It's a Canon 4K glass. It's about a $60,000 piece of optics. That's what we're dealing with. The camera is about the same.
Wow.
So it's
a chunk.
Yeah, it is. So as we wrap up, I kind of like to do the go around the room and give everybody a opportunity to say their final words in terms of inspiration for those who might be interested in pursuing a career like this. And I wanted to say too, Diane, I thought you brought up a really great point, and I think Chris, you brought that up too, about being involved in associations like an AOPA, EAA, a photographer, what, you know, these different types of associations, to just get in and, I hate to use that term, but network. And one of the things I do find out with young people is that they tend to be hesitant about, you know, just walking up and talking to somebody and things like that. And they don't know that we in aviation, we'll talk your head off. Just get us started and we'll roll from there.
Yeah.
So, but I think it's a very valid point. And it reminds me of something too. So another question that came up, and this is just kind of a general thing. Have any of you been invited to or considered doing a seminar about aerial photography at one of the, you know, at EAA Oshkosh or one of AOPA's events or one of MBAA's events or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I've done them at most of the major air shows. We do a program on aviation photography.
In several different lengths.
It's been as short as 45 minutes. And for some, when I do specific workshops for other organizations, sometimes they last as long as 3 or 4 hours. But it's hard to teach everything that you need to know about aviation photography in 45 minutes, obviously. But you know, I think that there's a lot of these types of discussions that go on at EAA chapters and different air shows around the country. Mm-hmm. There, you know, you have to look for them, and getting involved in organizations like Diane mentioned, as well as some specific aerial photography organizations, will help you find out where those opportunities are. And you know, it's just about getting there and getting in front of people and asking questions, because you're right. Pilots love to discuss aviation. So you will not find too many closed doors. And, you know, it's you'd be surprised how many people say, you know what, next time I go out on a mission, come along with me. You can sit in the back. You can watch what I'm doing. It doesn't always happen because of, you know, certain insurance issues and things like that. But, you know, I've taken a few people along, not in the back with me, but I've had other pilots that have come along just as safety pilots, or, you know, just, you know, helping with the radios or something else. We always try to include people that have an interest, because those people that have an interest might be the people that you hire, you know, in a couple of years for your organization. Yeah. We're always trying to grow that group of people that we can go to.
Any final thoughts, Chris?
No, just, you know, I think it's an exciting industry. It's a changing industry. And that's what's kept me involved in it for so many years. You know, just last week, I had the opportunity to be out in Southern California photographing. I did my first air-to-air photo shoot with an unmanned aircraft, which was really interesting. We went out there, Joby Aviation, which is based... in Southern California, or I'm sorry, kind of like mid California up around the
central
California up around San Jose. We were out there shooting that, and that was a new one for me. I'd never shot an unmanned vehicle before. So we give you a little sneak peek. This is going to be the cover of next month's AOPA pilot.
Oh, wow.
That's what it looks like.
What a shot.
And it is really an interesting vehicle. It's very unique, something I've never had much experience with before, but I think we're going to see a lot more of those electric powered aircraft in the future. And certainly some of the young people that are listening today are not only going to be seeing them flying, but very well maybe flying them in the next decade.
Awesome. Diane?
I think I would just say that, well, probably about 50% of the pilots I fly with also are interested in photography. So, and they're the ones that are out there flying every day and have the opportunities to be in the right place at the right time to get really cool pictures. So there's a lot of crossover interest in photography and aviation. And I just think there are a lot of careers that you don't know about until you learn about them. So when you get involved and make those connections, you know, the careers are gonna, you know, maybe present themselves to you. And so just start shooting and keep shooting, keep practicing, keep learning, and put yourself in position to take the pictures and get to know people.
Bob, as I always like to say, take us home.
Oh, well, I want to see people who have some enthusiasm, obviously, but also I need people who've had some accomplishment. They've shown that they can actually do this. There's a lot of pressure involved. We do shows, you know, and there's 20 people watching, you know, Super Bowl, 100 million. But you're up there by yourself with a pilot. So you're kind of detached from all of it. So it's kind of a surreal experience if you think about that. You know, I can remember doing Olympics, you know, and, you know, afterwards to see the ratings and the opening or the closing when you had the fireworks going off, you know, there was 100 million people watching. And it's, you never think about that. But some people really get crazy about that. But I want people who are dedicated, they can really concentrate on and be in the moment for what's going on. It's kind of an interesting deal because on one hand, the networks view us as a production company that does aerials, but on the aviation side, we're an aviation company. And I don't want to say there's conflict, but you've got to remember when we talk about the safety that foremost, we think of ourselves as an aviation company that does photography, because otherwise you get tied up in the hardware, you know,
that kind of makes a lot of sense, actually,
keeping the airplanes flying.
Absolutely. Well, listen, I'd like to thank all three of you for taking the time out again to join me with this show and to talk about what you do and what the opportunities are in the industry. It's been a real pleasure. Chris, always great to catch up with you.
Absolutely.
Bob, I felt like after our conversation, I had a new friend. And Diane, I love helicopters. but no, thank you everybody for that. Thanks for joining us. Hopefully gaining more valuable insight on another aspect of all things aviation and aerospace. As you may know, my goal with every show is to inspire anyone who is interested in any aspect of this great industry and to consider all options and possibilities. Next week, my guests will talk with me about being a, quote, space architect. The term is relatively new, but space architecture has been around since really the beginning of space travel. Think about it. Someone had to design the capsule, the moon rover, the International Space Station more recently, and make it habitable for the astronauts. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm Vince Mickens with All Things Aviation and Aerospace, a media presentation of Private Air Media. If you like what you're seeing and hearing, please subscribe. Until next time, take care, stay safe, blue skies, and have a good one.